From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. An investigation has been opened by the government of Turkey that could lead to charges of treason against a member of that country's parliament for alleging that ISIS used Turkish territory as a transit route to deliver deadly sarin gas to ISIS members in Syria in 2013. During last Thursday's session of parliament, two of its members publicly raised the charges.
A prosecutor said that some people in Turkey have contacts with the terrorist organization ISIL, supply and transport the key ingredient of sarin.
Those charges were picked up by some international media outlets, and Ankara's chief prosecutor's office opened the case against one of the MPs, Istanbul's Aaron Erdem of the Republican People's Party, after he gave an exclusive interview to RT, which aired this past Monday.
Chemical weapon materials were brought to Turkey and put together in ISIL camps in Syria, which was known as the Iraqi Al-Qaeda at the time. We have recordings to confirm this. A public prosecutor opened an investigation, which led to those involved being detained. A week later, another public prosecutor was assigned, and all the detainees were released. They left Turkey, crossing the Syrian border.
In that interview, Erdem detailed the evidence supporting his claims.
The phone recordings in the indictment showed all the details of how the shipment was going to be made, from how it was prepared, to the content, the labs, and the source of the materials, which trucks were going to be used, all dates, etc. From A to Z, everything was discussed and recorded. Despite all of this evidence, the suspects were released.
Those recorded wiretapped conversations exposed dealings with Al-Qaeda operative Hayim Kasab. Those events took place in 2013, at the time that a widely reported chemical attack took place in Syria on August 21st in Ghouta on the outer fringes of Damascus. Rockets containing sarin gas were reportedly fired, killing more than 1,400 people, including at least 426 children. The attack took place as a UN team of inspectors arrived in the city to investigate an alleged chemical attack 2 days earlier. Turkey and the U.S. blamed the Syrian government for the attacks.
Instead of being tucked safely in their beds at home, we saw rows of children lying side by side, sprawled on a hospital floor, all of them dead from Assad's gas and surrounded by parents and grandparents who had suffered the same fate.
Erdem also noted that the chemicals used for the production of weapons did not originate in Turkey.
The shipment is through Turkey, but all basic materials were purchased in Europe. Western sources know very well who carried out the sarin gas attack in Syria. They know that these people are working for Al-Qaeda. The West has been hypocritical over the whole situation. There's a high probability that it was carried out with materials shipped through Turkey. It was claimed regime forces were behind it, but in my opinion, examining the dates and the indictment, the Syrian government didn't have sarin gas. It was the attackers who possessed it. As far as I understand, this case was closed, just to place guilt on the Syrian government.
On Tuesday, Erdem issued a written statement in his defense, saying he had become the target of a smear campaign because of the statements he made in parliament. He also claimed he'd received death threats over social media following the publication of his interview with RT. Erdem said that the Turkish paramilitary organization Ottoman Hearths has published his home address in an effort to enable an attack on his house. In an interview with Turkey's Kanal 24 Tuesday, Cem Küçük, a columnist at the pro-government Star Daily, said that Erdem's claims about sarin gas should be regarded as treason. He said Erdem should be stripped of his parliamentary immunity to, quote, pay for his deeds, close quote. Turkish media reported Wednesday that the prosecutor's office is planning to send a summary of proceedings to the Ministry of Justice Thursday. Following that, the parliament could move to strip Erdem of his immunity. As for his accusations about Turkish businessmen being involved in supplying the Islamic State with the poisonous gas sarin and other reactants which are needed for chemical warfare, Erdem maintained that the statement was made based on results of the official 2013 investigation. The Nigerian military confirmed Wednesday that it was holding the country's top Shia Muslim cleric, Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zaghzaki, in custody following a raid on his residence. Nigeria's Major General Adeniyi Oyebade made the announcement.
I want to convey to you, members of the press, that the Shiite leader, al-Zaghzaki, is safe and in protective custody in a very secured facility. His wife is safe and also in protective custody. In the course of time, he himself will be speaking to his members.
General Oyebade confirmed that there were casualties during the raid, but provided no further details. According to a spokesperson for Nigeria's Shia Muslim movement, Zaghzaki was shot 4 times. On Saturday, Nigerian troops stormed a Shia Muslim gathering in the northern city of Zaria. They raided the house of the Shia cleric, who was due to address the gathering. Activists say hundreds or perhaps 1,000 or more Shia Muslims were killed in the raids. Nigeria's Human Rights Commission, Chidi Adinkalu, has called the attacks a massacre. Nigeria's authorities accused Zaghzaki of inciting supporters to assassinate the army chief who was in Zaria that day. Zaghzaki's followers have denied the allegations. Abraham Musa is a spokesperson for the Islamic Movement of Nigeria. Speaking via Skype from Kaduna, Nigeria, with Press TV's Marzi Hashimi, he said that the Shia leader was being held incommunicado at an unknown location, and he gave an estimate of up to 6,000 people killed by the military in the encounter.
The authorities still did not allow any member of the Islamic movement to see him, neither any member of his first family. But on his whereabouts also, we cannot say exactly. And on the casualty figures, so far there is another source that tells me that the figures might run into about 6,000 people dead.
But so far... 6,000, sir?
6,000 people, because a lot of Muslim brothers converge at the Sheikh's residence to give him protection. And these soldiers, on that fateful night, they killed almost everybody before they reached his house. But so far, or authoritatively, in the mortuary of the Ahmadu Bello Teaching Hospital, as I said earlier, there are about 800 corpses there.
Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford had just returned from a meeting in Beirut where he met with Sheikh Zaghzaki and his son, among others, when he heard the news. He filed this report Wednesday.
Ahmad Ibrahim, a soft-spoken, intelligent young man, accompanied his father, Sheikh Ibrahim Zaghzaki, the leader of Nigeria's Shia Muslims, to a conference on solidarity with Palestine in Beirut last week. I was there, along with other reporters and activists. Young Ahmad told our group that Boko Haram, the Nigerian jihadists, are terrorist thugs who get their weapons and money from both Nigerian and foreign donors, just like the Islamic State, with which Boko Haram is aligned. Ahmad's father, Sheikh Zaghzaki, is recognized as a force for reconciliation among the various religious and ethnic groups in Nigeria. But Zaghzaki's Shia followers have been targeted by both Boko Haram and the Nigerian military, which has long been suspected of manipulating Boko Haram to its own ends. The Nigerian army killed 3 of the Sheikh's sons in 2009 during a march against the Israeli occupation of Jerusalem. By this weekend, Ahmad was also dead, killed shortly after he arrived back in his country by the Nigerian military in a massacre of unarmed Shia Muslims that left his father with bullet wounds in both hands. The military claims that the Sheikh's followers were plotting to kill the Army Chief of Staff when his motorcade was blocked by demonstrators. But it was pure murder on a massive scale, with as many as 1,000 dead and 200 bodies piled up at a morgue on the outskirts of town. The military then bulldozed a Shia shrine and Sheikh Zaghzaki's home. One of the Sheikh's followers, Bukhari Muhammad Bello Jaka, wrote on his Facebook page that the real Boko Haram is now on the loose in the form of the Nigerian army, bombing buildings and killing innocent civilians. Soon after posting that message, Mr. Bello Jaka was also killed by soldiers, along with his wife and infant child. It is not strange at all that the Nigerian military, which for years did little to halt the rise of Boko Haram terror, has unleashed a hell on earth for peaceful Shia Muslims. Saudi Arabia, the fountainhead of funding for jihadists all over the world, has just formed its own bizarre coalition against terror, made up of 34 nations from Pakistan to sub-Saharan Africa, including Nigeria and its West African neighbors in Chad, Togo, Senegal, Sierra Leone, Gabon, Guinea, and the Ivory Coast. For the Saudis to be leading a war against terror is like the Pope leading a war against Catholicism. Everything the Saudis touch turns into terror and chaos. The Saudi brand of Wahhabist Islam calls for the eradication of Shia Muslims and secular governments worldwide, a crusade that the United States finds convenient to its own imperial purposes. When both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton say that Arabs and Muslims must fight their own war against terror, they are actually endorsing Saudi Arabia's leadership of the Muslim world and the spread of proxy jihadist armies throughout Africa and Asia. West Africa is the next front line in these jihadist wars, which have already claimed so many of Sheikh Zakzaki's sons. The resulting chaos will be used to justify further U.S. military penetration of the African continent under the pretext of putting out the fires that they themselves have set. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Hey, 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 hey!
Ho, ho!
Ho, ho!
I need a run, you got to go!
Hey, hey,
hey, hey!
Ho, ho!
Ho, ho!
I need a run, you got to go!
That was the sound of protesters in Chicago Tuesday, as they blocked off West Congress Parkway in downtown, demanding justice in the case of the police shooting of black teen Laquan McDonald. 16 people were arrested after they held a sit-in, blocking a busy intersection, demanding the resignation of Mayor Rahm Emanuel and Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez. The demonstration was organized by the Chicago Light Brigade, which said that the 16 people who were arrested for blocking the intersection took part in that act of civil disobedience to represent the number of times McDonald was shot by police in 2014. He was killed by Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke, who faces murder charges. He spent 30 years on Pennsylvania's death row until his death sentence was finally overturned in 2011, and imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal has spent the better part of this past year fighting for his life again, but this time at the hands of the private health care providers that contract with the state's prison system. After a near-death experience at the hand of prison doctors earlier this year, Mumia's case will go before a federal judge this Friday. For more on this, we spoke with Noel Hanrahan, who's been the audio link between Mumia's voice and the outside world for the past few decades. I understand that Mumia gets a day in court on Friday, and it's a federal court.
You know, this is very historic. Mumia Abu-Jamal is going to be testifying by video at this hearing, and really his life is on the line. We are demanding in federal court life-saving hepatitis C treatment. There's a cure, and Mumia has been extraordinarily sick this year, and the disease is continuing to ravage his skin and his liver. And so we need the Department of Corrections to do this right now, and we are in court in Scranton on Friday.
Maybe give us a little history of his case, because this has been an ongoing problem, and there's been one neglect, you know, after another from the state.
So Mumia is like every black man in America, and he's also somewhat unique. So at times the state especially targets him, and at times it's just what happens in a culture that is so incredibly racist, that uses race and class and place as a way to control the population. I mean, everybody knows that we have the largest prison population in the world and that it dramatically affects everything. Now, for Mumia Abu-Jamal, he was a journalist in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, covering one of the most repressive regimes, the Rizzo, the Frank Rizzo regime. It was really suppressing any level of Black self-determination and consciousness. And they did target Mumia Abu-Jamal. So they targeted him in a lot of ways, economically, making him lose jobs when he was doing really great work. And he was targeted when he was arrested at the scene of a murder and charged with a murder, ultimately convicted. That was in 1981 and 1982. And he literally was framed. I mean, he was framed for this murder. He's innocent. He's been in prison for 34 years. He was on death row for 30 years. Yet many of your audience know of him, that he remained an incredibly prolific journalist. Mumia Abu-Jamal is the voice of the voiceless. He records and produces through prison radio commentaries every single week. He's the author of 8 books. So he's really somebody who defines what's happening in America, you know, in the last 30 years, the way in which all the work for progress and self-determination has been controlled by the regime, you know, really, literally, the capitalist American juggernaut does not only colonize people and conduct foreign wars. It conducts wars here to repress people.
And his illness was going on for a long time and not being treated, and ultimately almost killed him.
Yeah. You know, Mumia, there is no viable health care in prison. And Mumia has always known that. There's this amazing piece that he wrote way back in the 90s called Manny's Attempted Murder. And if you listen to that piece, you'll understand what Mumia's relationship to prison health care is. I mean, it's very, very disturbing what happens to people who require care in prison, who have emergency situations. So I always knew that if Mumia had an appendectomy, that he might die. That he might become septic, because I did not think that the prison was capable of responding to that kind of situation. So at one point, very early on, he had like what presented as gout, and it was very debilitating. He had a hard time walking. And so we developed a medical and a legal team to take care of him so that he felt like he had some options that were different than what the prison was prescribing. So we had him in touch with these doctors, and we had a legal team working on getting an independent medical exam for what was presenting like gout. That resolved, and Mumia then did not access healthcare. He didn't have the independent medical exam, but the team was in place. So when this medical crisis began, he had been sick for a while. He had open wounds, and he had this severe, severe skin rash. But it got to the point where he was in the infirmary, and people noticed that he was very sick. And so Pam Africa and Keith Cook went to see him and mobilized this response team. And so I was leading the medical response team to get in place the necessary tools to get Mumia healthcare and to make sure that they treated him in the emergency fashion that he needed.
So maybe you could describe some of the medical issues that arose over the course of this.
So they were trying to treat Mumia's skin rash with a topical steroid. That topical steroid, literally a side effect of it, is diabetes. And so Mumia had a diabetic reaction to the topical steroid. He had skin lesions and wounds and open wounds over 80% of his body. He was extraordinarily sick. So they applied this topical steroid. He immediately had a blood sugar spike. They noted it in the prison in his records that they should monitor it. Well, for you and I, they would have sent us to the hospital for a 400 level blood sugar. But they said continue to monitor in his records and his charts in the infirmary. Well, they didn't continue to monitor his care. And 3 weeks later, without any monitoring, he went into diabetic shock. He fell out, luckily was transported to an outside hospital, and he was minutes from dying. He was in renal failure. So that hospital then shipped him back to the infirmary merely when he was stable, not after really any treatment or any diagnostic testing. Literally, they stabilized him and shipped him out of there. We went, that was like on March 30th and the first beginning of April, we went into full on real activist mode, and we demanded that he get a full diagnostic workup and get transferred to a tertiary care medical facility, which he did. So the lawyers then were demanding, engaging, working it, getting it done. And so we have been in that battle for the last 9 months. This is the culmination of that battle. We're at a hearing in federal court challenging the Department of Corrections' insistence that Mumia Abu-Jamal is not sick enough to get treatment for hepatitis C. He has active hepatitis C. There is a cure. There's a cure to hepatitis C, 90% cure rate, one pill a day for 12 weeks. And we believe that that is the medically indicated standard of care and that Mumia Abu-Jamal and all prisoners deserve that level of care.
And they've denied it.
Yes. I mean, in a way, it's good. I mean, they're unequivocal. They are completely denying Mumia Abu-Jamal any care for hepatitis C. When he went to the tertiary medical facility, it cost them $125,000. They did 5 biopsies, right? They did every test except the test for active hepatitis C because they didn't want to know. Because it's clear that there's an economic equation. They don't want to treat people because the capitalist corporation that owns the drug that is the cure is charging outrageous prices for it. So Gilead is charging like $84,000 for the course of treatment, for the 12-week treatment. Now, I believe that those prices will come down with generics. They'll come down with negotiations. They'll come down because people fight to have that cure. It's a medical public health imperative. This is the largest infectious disease in the country. It's affecting over 3 million people. Adversely affects people of color. 1 in 7 African-American men are hepatitis C positive. It's a silent disease. You can have it and not know it for 20 years. It actively affects and damages people's livers. So what's really important that for people to understand right now is that if Mumia Abu-Jamal does not get this care, he will have irreversible liver damage. They are allowing this disease to continue when they have a cure. And it's possible. I mean, he can get this care. The drug prices are going to come down. They're not going to have the excuse that they can't afford it. And it's a public health imperative. I don't care that the company, Correct Care Solutions, that got the contract to deliver health care for Pennsylvania prisoners, is going to lose its shirt. I think, look, it's a public health imperative. We need to treat them like they're our brothers, like they're our sisters, like they're our mothers. They are our people, and they need adequate health care. Mumia also needs to be free, and we're working really hard on that. Like, Mumia's escape plan is through the front door. I mean, we're going to get that man out. So, and it's because of you guys. I mean, it's true. Every little action matters. Every single act, every action, every time that you invoke Mumia's name and invoke freedom in the same breath, it means that we're closer to freedom.
The company that owns this drug paid $8 billion for it and in the first year made 10. Is that right?
That's correct. So the chemist who solved the problem of treating and curing hepatitis C is Michael Sophia. He lives in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. He founded and worked for a company called Pharmastat. A couple of years ago, this was in 2013, Pharmastat got bought by Gilead for like $8 billion. The first year that Gilead had this product, they made $10 billion. So they already made back what they paid for it. They can't use the excuse that they're using this money to develop new drugs.
Right.
Also, just so people know, pressure works. The country of India went to Gilead and said, we're not going to honor any of your intellectual property. So you're going to come to us, and they got a deal where they're paying pennies for the drug. Same with Egypt. There's a front page article in the New York Times magazine that talks about Egypt has gotten the drugs from Gilead because they went to Gilead and said, we're going to make the, we're going to quickly, very quickly make the generic because Egypt had a vaccine delivery mechanism that involved needles that weren't sterilized. And so Egypt has the highest percentage of people with hepatitis C, very significant percentage of their population. And so they have a particular issue. So they went and said, look, you're going to license to this to us at a very low rate, pennies, or we're just going to bypass you altogether because it's a public health imperative. We need to treat our people. So pressure works. And the same happened with AIDS drugs, that the pressure on the AIDS drug companies to lower the prices absolutely worked. And that's going to happen in this case as well.
So what can people do to help move this along for on Mumia's behalf?
Get in touch with us. Any group that's working on Mumia's case, get in touch with them. Stay in touch with them. Look for the information. You can go to www.prisonradio.org. You'll be right on the cusp of everything.
And that's at prisonradio.org.
That's right.
Noel Hanrahan, thank you very much.
Take good care.
And at that Prison Radio website, again, www.prisonradio.org, you can hear Mumia's commentary going back at least as far as 2002. We bring you now the latest in the series of commentaries from imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Badge of the Rapist Racist. As the first phase of the trial of police officer Daniel Holdsclaw comes to a close, one is forced to take stock of what the trial and its coverage means. Holdsclaw, a 28-year-old white Oklahoma cop, was recently convicted of 18 charges of sexual assault, rape, sodomy, and related offenses, and the targeting and raping of some 13 black women, from teens to a woman in her 50s. An Oklahoma jury recommended the man be sentenced to some 260-plus years in prison. If you blinked, however, you would have missed it. A serial rapist of 13 females. When isn't that a story? When the 13 women are black women. Only one cable network, the black-owned TV One news program, hosted by former CNN contributor Roland Martin, covered the case using internet reports from persons in court. No one else, not one. Why not? Apparently, black lives don't matter. Holdsclaw used his uniform, his badge, his service revolver to stop, intimidate, and rape over a dozen women. Sometimes in his own patrol vehicle. And amazingly, he raped a teenager on her porch. And people wonder why cops can't be trusted. It took DNA and GPS evidence to bust this dude. But how can anyone contemplate something so sick? Easy. Most of the victims were poor black women. Some charged with being sex workers. Others charged with being drug violators. In other words, the vulnerable. This cop chose those who he knew had no social power and little ability to resist. And media silence reinforced that negative narrative by belittling the worth of these women. If they had covered it, they would have cast a harsh national light on police practices. They chose not to. Like a cop standing over a body in the road, they essentially said, hey, keep on moving. There's nothing to see here. Keep moving. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.